Blog Talk Radio. Eastern family and friends, and welcome to the Eastern Radio Show and our 39th radio episode, coming to you live from Jacksonville, Florida, Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, Roaring Gap, North Carolina, and Grand Junction, Colorado. I'm Margaret Barrs, one of your hosts for tonight's show. Our other hosts include Neil Holland in Jacksonville, Jim Hart on Martha's Vineyard, Steve Thompson in Roaring Gap, and Bill Joseph in Grand Junction, Colorado. And, of course, our producer-engineer is Eric Otero, computer wizard extraordinaire. Now, you may call us tonight at either of our two phone numbers, 1-213-816-1611, or toll-free 1-877-572-1861. You can also send us a message on the chat feature of the webpage that you're logged into. Either way, we do want to hear from you. We try to bring you various stories from Eastern's past, from those who participated in its history. Now, our lines are open right after the program we have for you tonight. We've collected several stories from the past that were written by Eastern people about the memories and experiences during their years with the company. We're planning to use many of these in a published book, which for now is simply called Eastern Memories. We hope the book will be available around Christmas of this year. It certainly will make a great gift for the holidays, and we hope you'll place your order as soon as we get a published price. It'll be available through the website's web store.
Grease Jobs by Tom Bartley. Every pilot knows that the formula for a paint job landing includes an element of luck. In fact, I think this might be said of just about any landing to a greater or lesser degree. Some days you couldn't make a bad one if you tried, and other days you couldn't hit the ground with your hat. Once in a while, a miracle will happen, and you can't even feel it when the wheels touch the runway. This kind of a miracle happened to me once, and only once, in a DC-3. It was the most incredible landing I ever made. I still can't explain it. In the big airplanes, of course, it does happen once in a while, and there are a lot of distance and a lot of weight between the pilot and the wheels, but in a DC-3, never. Yet here's what happened. I was flying co-pilot with the late A.B. Duke in the spring of 1940, landing in Nashville one night en route from Atlanta to Chicago, trying for a three-pointer, which was always very difficult. With half flaps, I made a normal approach, flared, held it off, waited for it to touch down. I waited and waited and waited. Finally, I realized we weren't flying. We were rolling. I never felt it touch. Neither did Duke. We were both completely dumbfounded. No, it wasn't a wet runway, and I have no idea what happened. But I know the old horseshoe was really working. In later years, in the big airplanes, I used to pretend, with tongue-in-cheek, that I could call my shots on those accidental grease jobs. Now you see, it's how it's done. Now you see how it's done, young man. I don't want to have to show you again, so on. Of course, the automatic wisecracks, which immediately follow that kind of a landing, are an essential part of the ritual. Ain't those show-off guys. Don't look now, but I think we're on the ground. What was the on time? Well, it was a little hard to tell. Not a bad landing, Captain. But you let it get away from you, didn't you? Bill Nelson had the copyright on this one. We'll talk about it in the postscript later on. Sometimes when a co-pilot that I knew real well, came up with a super smoothie, I would say, go back in the back and tell them the captain made that one. Well, Bill Westhaver nailed me on that one day. He painted one on like a paper on a wall, and then as we walked back to the cabin, he said, nice and loud, boy, you're really in the groove today. Actually, Westhaver didn't have to say anything to make the captain look good. All he had to do was fly the airplane. But, of course, luck runs both ways. The good and the bad balance out, and you break even, supposedly. Actually, I think I came out ahead in the game on that in the long run. I remember a certain trip from New York to from New York in a DC-8 in which neither the first officer nor I really made a decent landing the entire flight out and back. And it was a trip with five or six stops. Finally, on arrival back to JFK, I was determined to end up with a good one, but I didn't. Crash, bang, and we were on the ground. And the second officer was Gene Smythe. And he sat there through and at the engineer's panel and suffered through the whole thing of these cruddy landings. Gene had a dry whip guy. He was a dry wit guy and excellent pilot himself, which made him fully eligible to put the needle to both of us on for the bad landings. As we taxied to the ramp, he came up with a wry observation. I know I'm just supposed to take care of the panel sitting back here, but I just have to compliment you guys. You sure do make good takeoffs. Touché. I think very few professional pilots really get too upset over an occasional bad landing. Of course, nobody likes to make a bad one, but you can't go back and do it over again. It's no good to be a prima donna about it. So that's that. Still, it can be embarrassing, especially if you become impatient with a co-pilot and take over on final with an exasperated comment such as, damn it, let me show you how to put one of these down in a crosswind, and then you mess it up, which is exactly what I did one afternoon in Newark on the old trip 508, which is Super C L-1011 Constellation, which may have been the best crosswind airplane that we had during the time I was with Eastern. I showed the young men all right how not to make a crosswind landing, that is. I wish I could charge that one off to luck, but some days you can't make a dime. And there's a postscript about my friend Bill Nelson. I can't find any place to fit this into the story and into a soliloquy about landings, but I think it is a classic story about that should be told. When Bill applied for a job with Eastern, he was interviewed in New York by Captain Johnny Gill, who told him that the company wouldn't hire him because he didn't meet the minimum height requirements. I think Bill was about 5'7", and we wanted at least 5'8" or something like that. Now, for the information of any young members who may not have known the late, great John Francis Gill, he too was a sawed-off little bulldog, but a hell of a good chief pilot. No taller than Nielsen. Bill looked him in the eye like a cocky little bantam rooster and said, I can fly anything you can fly. And then Johnny Gill replied, go down to Miami and tell Frank Kern I sent you, which speaks well for both of them, Bill Nielsen and Johnny Gill in my book.
Jim Hart? Captains Bill, well, the past few years have been issues, FRT, about some interesting and stories about Gil Waller. Gil was a great and was, I'm sorry, Gil was great and was a few friends of the mine and kept in touch with the, until he passed away, until February 2/1938. I was privileged to hear from him again and tell him about one of the tales. Captain Gil Waller had already started the story when I wandered up to the group of hangar flyers around him. It happened in 1923. He was saying I was the Army detailed and a camperman and a D-14 and make a mapping survey of a section of Texas sailors. The job was to take a week, and nothing more out of the ordinary happened until I did a risky and loop and a crazy one day. When we landed, the cameraman acted a little bit peeved. He told me that he didn't like one day. When we landed, the cameraman, although I did a job.
Hey, Jim. Jim, this is Neil. Your microphone is cutting on and off, so we're going to have to forego our. I can tell the rest of that story because your phone, apparently your reception is not good enough, and it's coming in broken. So if you don't mind, let me read the rest of that story because I think it's a very good one. And but we were talking about Captain Gil Waller. And so we were on the last day's work, cruising along, minding our own business, when two eagles loomed up in front of the ship. I maneuvered out of the way of one of the birds, but the other crashed into one of the outer bay wing struts. The impact threw the plane out of control. When I regained my bearings, the controls were loose and sloppy. I looked at the broken strut, expecting to see part of the wing rip loose. But the wing was intact, and the eagle caught there was still alive. It was lodged somehow between the top of the strut and a brace wire. Several other wires were trailing behind the wing. I moved the joystick, but the ailerons did not respond. The crash had snapped the aileron control wires. The plane was out of lateral control. The ship began to spiral tightly. We began to lose altitude fast. I knew we would end in a spin, and if something was not done immediately. I tried all the tricks I knew, but nothing seemed to work. I turned back to the cameraman and gave him a sign to jump and use his chute. He was not looking in my direction, but instead was watching the eagle on the strut. His eyes, which I could see through his goggles, were wide with astonishment. I followed his gaze. The eagle seemed to have revived. One of his wings was free, and he seemed to be making an effort to straighten it. You could see by his expression that it was very difficult, but he finally made it. The effect was noticeably instantly. The spiral loosened up. Soon we were making a wide turn. I looked intently at the bird, and he seemed to understand what he was doing. I motioned downward with my hand, and his wing went down. We were now in a straight glide. The terrain below was pretty flat, so there was little other maneuvering to do. However, we were flying downwind, so I motioned for a turn to the bird into the wind. As the eagle strived to obey, I could easily see that it was taking his very last bit of strength to dip his wings still further. I cut the engine, and we landed. I looked at the eagle. He was looking at me, and he smiled, the smile of a hero as he died. And that, concluded Captain Waller, is my story.
Nostalgia Corner, DC 3 days, a true story. One day, shortly after the end of World War II, Bud Vanderford, station manager at Nashville, had just closed out Flight 181, and returned to his desk to take care of some paperwork when in stalked one of the control tower operators. Normally, this individual was a quiet, easygoing, happy-go-lucky guy, but not this day. Rather, he skipped normal greetings, and with a very definite "I've been had" expression on his face, he blurted out, "Who is that clown flying Flight 181? Bud thought better of giving out names under the circumstances, and instead he asked what happened. The visitor then continued, "Well, this is so-and-so. This so-and-so called back after I gave him ATC clearance and airport information and said he was new on this run and would be most grateful if I'd tell him the way from here to Birmingham. I told him to hold on a minute and I'd get my charts and give him a heading. But before I could do so, he came roaring back at me and said, 'Hold on, Tower, I don't want any of that degree stuff. Just point me in the right direction.' Well, by this time, Bud was approaching the choking stage but wasn't about to foul this one up and somehow managed to ask, 'What happened then?' 'Well,' said his visitor, I had given him clearance for takeoff on runway 20, and since takeoff on this runway is just about the right heading for Birmingham, I pointed out those two hills a few miles south of the field, and he assured me he could see them well. So I told him to fly directly between them, and he would be right on course. Then he said, 'The captain's reply to these instructions was, man, that's exactly what I wanted. Thanks a million. You are a gentleman and a scholar. See you next trip.' Well, as you may have guessed, Bud completely cracked up at this point, and his visitor became so upset that he left without learning that he had been had by the old master himself, Captain George F. Bost, naturally."
Elva Libby. When travel once again became available to civilians after World War II, I experienced my first flight as a passenger on a DC-3. I crouched in sheer terror with my eyes closed for the duration of the flight, vowing never again to board an airplane. The terror remained on tap. My eyes remained closed. However, I did go on to fly in many planes as a stewardess. I stopped crouching and managed to walk upright in the prescribed manner, wearing spectator pump shoes. The only time I regressed to my crouching position was when I fell in and out of the cockpit over the wing spar. The second prescribed manner was the squat, which one had to master to retain a semblance of proximity with the jump seat. The jump seat was so named due to its ability to jump out from under the precariously perched victim. The next challenge was the hat, which repeatedly fell off as a result of hitting against the ceiling. The solution was quite simple. One merely walked with bowed head. Many times necessity was mistaken for humility, for which I did receive rave reviews. I easily adjusted to walking with one hand on the overhead rack for balance. I became so accomplished, I can still do it. When one is well trained, one never forgets. The airport identification symbols were difficult to memorize because they became confused with the table of elements. Three similar jugs on every flight were coffee, oxygen, and fire extinguisher. Extreme caution had to be exercised to avoid pouring a cup of oxygen or strapping on a mask of coffee. Viewing traffic lights on streets below through the open door assured me that door closing had not been mastered. Automobile headlights were excellent guides for landing, especially where no other lights were available. In appreciation for lighting our landings, we often gave the auto owners a tour of the Lockheed Lodestar. They were awed by its large size and capacity of 14 passengers. Extension and step ladders were often used for mounting and dismounting one's aircraft. And on the smaller planes, there were no public address systems. One simply shouted. When later exposed to the public address system on the larger planes, many stewardesses were wary. Some never did adapt and continued to shout. Light rain outside always meant heavy rain inside the DC-3. It and the C-46 and the Lodestar were tail draggers and assumed a steep angle when on the ground. Walking uphill, rear to front was exhausting. Running downhill, front to rear, could be so exhilarating. Speed had to be controlled to prevent one from shooting out the door. The DC-4 was the first level floored plane on the ground. We employed the following checklist to assure this altitude or attitude. Stewards to agent, pull up. Agent to stewardess, pull up. Stewardess to captain, pull up. The sophisticated equipment and profound checklists were indeed taxing. With the advent of the DC-6s, two revolutionary items were introduced, pressurization and a level standing sans pole. Additionally, the Convair, the DC-6B, DC-7, and Super Constellation, in which I flew, contained these features. A new era had begun. And so in commemoration of my early years aloft, I bronzed my Spectator pumps.
As the big plane left LaGuardia Airport, the lives of two men came together for the last time, each a tower in his own field. Each had climbed from a lowly beginning to a position of wealth and power. Self-made men, they were called, but there were great personal differences. Alfred Damon Runyon enlisted in the Spanish-American War by exaggerating his age. He later served as a war correspondent in World War I. He became a prolific writer, poet, playwright, and novelist, but was best known for his short stories, which centered around Broadway, its strange assortment of people, its gamblers and promoters. Using a unique style concocted of underworld argot and the present tense, his talent drew attention from both readers and producers. 16 of his stories were made into movies. The Broadway musical, Guys and Dolls, was based on his stories of the same name. Runyon was short and dapper, bespectacled in his later years. He was a shy, quiet introvert who masked his feelings under the pose of a professional tough guy.
Edward Vernon Rickenbacker. He was born on the wrong side of the tracks in Columbus, Ohio. He left school in his early teens to help support his family. His hard climb led him to become an automobile mechanic, a racetrack driver, and a chauffeur for Colonel William J. Billy Mitchell in World War I. Transferring to the Army Air Service, he learned to fly in France and became America's top ace with 26 victories to his credit. Captain Eddie Rickenbacker had returned to America as a hero. After failing as a builder of the Rickenbacker automobile, he joined General Motors, touring the country to promote their cars. They later made him general manager of their subsidiary, Eastern Airlines, and he then bought the company, building it into one of America's greatest airlines. He was tall and big-boned with a commanding manner, which made him stand out as a leader in any group. He was also tough and demanding, yet also always ready to respond to any call for help. It was because of such a call for this special flight, the Eastern Airlines DC-3 Silverliner was climbing for an altitude as it headed down the Hudson River on December 18, 1946. Captain John F. Gill, a veteran pilot, was in command. If anyone could be said to be in command when Captain Eddie Rickenbacker was on board, Captain Eddie Barber, whose red hair and jovial manner made him one of Eastern's best-liked pilots, sat in the co-pilot seat.
The flight attendant gave a cheery good morning to Mr. and Mrs. Damon Runyon Jr. as they entered the cabin. To Captain Rickenbacker, who boarded last, there was a warm, "Good morning, Captain," and the captain responded, as he always did, with a, "How are things going, Joe?" Captain Eddie was forever probing for information. That's probably the reason he was most knowledgeable ahead of any airline. As the three people took their seats near the rear of the cabin, the flight attendant went about the business of making them comfortable. He stored their wraps in the rear of the cabin. Hats were placed in the overhead rack. He switched the reading light on and pulled out the ventilator over each passenger's seat. As he gave them each a small pillow, he said, "If you need anything, just press the button," and motioned his hand towards it. Eastern flight attendants were thoroughly trained to look after the passengers' comfort, attentive but not obsequious. The flight attendant was puzzled. There was an awkwardness about the box Damon Runyon Jr. held on his lap. Strange, thought the flight attendant, that he had seen and handled hundreds of packages during the last week or so. But it was the Christmas season. Salvation Army bells were ringing even as the passengers boarded the plane, and almost every holiday passenger had one or more packages to be stowed away. Yet the flight attendant hesitated to offer help with this box, which was wrapped in brown paper and tied with a heavy cord. So instead, he offered the passengers Chiclets.
Captain Rickenbacker sat across the aisle from two guests. His presence caused the flight attendant more concern because the boss was always conscious of cabin service. There simply was no way to say it. Can I put it in the seat in front of you? Would you be more comfortable if I put it on the floor? No, that wouldn't do. The roar of the engines evened out and became a funeral dirge as the Silver Liner headed for the Statue of Liberty. In the end, he decided that this was a case where doing nothing was the best choice, so he quietly remained in the rear of the cabin. Before long, there was the sound of a buzzer, and the flight attendant went up the aisle and into the pilot's compartment. Returning, he quietly spoke to Captain Rickenbacker, who got up, nodded to Damon Jr., and walked up front. The younger man followed him into the pilot's compartment and pulled the door closed. Somehow, the flight attendant felt some gesture to Mrs. Runyon was in order, since she was now alone in his cabin. She accepted a cold drink, but required nothing else. In the pilot's compartment, Eddie Barber moved from the co-pilot seat, and Captain Rickenbacker awkwardly eased himself into the right side seat. His ankle still bothered him. It was a carryover of the injuries he sustained in the 1941 crash of a DC-3 sleeper in Atlanta.
Damon Jr. passed the box to Captain Rickenbacker, who removed the wrappings and gingerly handled a heavy bronze urn. Being a practical man, he used the heavy cord from the box to secure the urn, with one end tied around the neck, the other tied to his right wrist just in case. The captain next pulled back the sliding window on his right, a job made more difficult with his right wrist fettered to the urn and the cramped quarters. Damon Jr., standing beside Eddie Barber in the crowded aisle behind the pilot seats, was fascinated by the multitude of dials and knobs, levers and switches. Then his eyes caught the urn the captain was holding, and the wasted years flashed through his mind. Their differences on so many things, trivial they now seemed, placed distance between them. There were many things they had in common. One was alcohol. Like his father, he was a newspaper reporter and writer, though not as successful. By a wry twist of fate, their reconciliation came about through writing letters and short messages his father passed to him after surgeons had removed his power of speech. He had followed in his father's footsteps, and too late, they then came to find the law that only a father and son can know. As the captain sat holding the urn in his lap, waiting for Johnny Gill to reach the agreed-upon location, his mind took him back to France, where he first met the American war correspondent in 1918. The next time he saw him was when he called upon the great newspaper reporter and writer for help in preparing himself for the patriotic speeches he was so ill-prepared to give but was expected to make on the Liberty Bond tour. It was in early 1919. He had been brought back to America to tour the country, but his skill and courage in the air did not prepare him for the challenge on the speaker's platform. That he had a successful tour was in large part the result of help from the man who was no more. His reverie was broken by a touch on his shoulder and Eddie Barber's voice. "Coming up, Captain."
As the plane steadied over Broadway, Captain Johnny Gill nodded to Rickenbacker to indicate they were approaching Times Square. The window was about level with his face, requiring him to twist around to the right, carefully placing the neck of the urn out of the window while holding it with his two hands, a most awkward situation. He tilted the container to let the contents escape. There was a sudden cloud of dust as the lighter ashes were sucked into the cockpit. But the solemn task was over. Captain Rickenbacker quickly withdrew the urn after giving it a final upturn. He was coughing and wheezing and trying to get to his handkerchief, but his hand was firmly tied to the now empty bronze urn. The others inhaled a share of the contents, but Rickenbacker, whose face was only inches from the window, received the full impact. It shouldn't have happened. The crew was thoroughly familiar with the idiosyncrasies of the ventilating system of the cockpit. By opening the sliding windows on each side, the intake of air could be regulated, but things in the pilot's compartment were anything but normal. Rickenbacker occupied the co-pilot seat. Johnny Gill was more or less watching Broadway. Eddie Barber and Damon Jr. were awkwardly standing behind the pilot seat. To have told the captain how to handle the window, or anything for that matter, would have been like Peter telling Jesus how to heal the sick. The confusion was soon cleared up. Rickenbacker freed himself from the urn, which he passed back to Damon Jr. Damon Runyon's last wish had been carried out. His ashes, or most of them, were floating down along the Great White Way, which had been so much part of his life. But there was a portion which would continue to fly the routes of Eastern as long as that ship kept to the air. Rickenbacker was still having a problem as he deplaned. His eyes were a bit red, and he was blowing his nose as Johnny Gill, noting the time, said, "Going to have lunch at the airport, Captain?" Eddie Rickenbacker looked at him and snorted, "We just had Damon for lunch."
Remembering Captain Van Hus. Van Hus always liked to get people off balance with his first acquaintance. Later he would endear himself to them by, but to start with, he wanted them at a disadvantage. As an example of this, a stewardess who had never flown with Van came to the cockpit at the beginning of the trip to introduce herself to the captain. "Hello, I'm Peggy." "Hello." More of a grunt than a word. "What's your name?" asked the girl. "Van Hus." "What's your first name?" "Captain." Van delighted in taking a fine point of difference or a minor word interpretation ambiguity and making fuel for what to the other person was a large and very overblown argument. As an example, I can cite the time Van was going through the ground school for the Lockheed Electra. The instructor was explaining the workings of the landing gear, and the impression had been created that the landing gear would accidentally retract while the plane was on the ground and had weight on the gear. The instructor was going to great pains to dispel this illusion. After carefully explaining how over-the-center locks and safety switches could be overridden, the instructor added, "So, if the gear handles move to the up positions, a wheel will come up." "No, it won't," came a voice from the back of the room. It was Van Hus. The instructor sighed. Every class seemed to have one of the people who never could grasp the simple mechanical logic. Patiently, he reviewed the information as he had covered previously and again finished with the words, "And the down latch mechanism will be overridden and the wheels will come up. Now, is that clear?" The answer was forthcoming immediately. "You're wrong. The wheels will not come up." Again, it was Van Hus, thinly disguising his rapidly diminishing capacity to tolerate such denseness. The instructor sneered and asked, "Well, if you're so well informed about the electric gear, let's all hear your explanation." Well, Van drew his 6-foot-1-inch body to a full height and with deadly serious expression on his face explained, "Sir, if you put the gear handle in the up position, the wheels will not come up with the weight on the gear. The plane will sit down on the wheels, but they will stay right where they are."
Well, we hope you've enjoyed these stories from the past and have some of... Oh, no. I think Luann... Is that Luann coming?
I think I do.
Oh,
I think
no.
I hear Luann.
There she goes. Oh, that's... Hi, everybody. everybody. How y'all doing? I'm calling in to respond to a question that Captain Steve Thompson asked me the other day about our rigorous application process we have at our Kentucky for hiring pilots. So, Captain Steve, you know, we do ask for a name and an address, of course, and then we have simply five basic questions that we ask. Now, Steve, I'm going to ask you these questions, see if you know them, but Neil, Bill, feel free to jump right in case Steve can't answer these, all right? Hey, Steve, are you there?
Anna, thank you. Yes, I'm here.
Okay, here's your first question. Let's see if you can make it as a pilot on our Kentucky. We're rough and tough. What is the capital of Kentucky? Is it Louisville or Louisville?
Well, I always refer to it as Louisville.
Ha, ha, ha. You missed it. It's Frankfort. Now, if you were a true Kentuckian, you would know that. Now, I understand you spent some time in Kentucky, didn't you?
Well, I visited a place that was very near you, yes, and I'm scared to death, but I did.
Was that Hardin County by chance?
Somebody referred to it as Bloody Harlan. I don't know why they referred to it as that.
Well, now, those people from Breathitt County would take exception to that because it's Bloody Breathitt. But I don't think I'd, I just think I'd be careful when I went through Hardin, too. Okay, so you missed the first one. Let's go to number two. What is the color of Kentucky's beautiful green grass? Now, not the smoking kind, though. What is
it
the color of the grass?
It is really pretty green, dark green.
Neil, Bill, you want to help him out?
Well, Bill?
I don't have any idea. I was going to say greens as well.
Well, I think I would have said blue.
That's right, Captain Neil. It's Kentucky bluegrass.
Well, I'm hard.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you got one. That'd be good. All right, now this one's all really, really critical. Now, in what city of Kentucky is anyone, and this is a law now, anyone who's been drinking is considered sober until he or she cannot hold on to the ground? This is true.
Okay, would you say that again now?
In what city of Kentucky is anyone who's been drinking considered sober until he or she cannot hold on to the ground? Now, this is a real problem.
I think that's Lexington.
Well, you are so correct. Oh, my gosh. Well, you got one out of three. We might hire you yet. All right, number four. When our Kentucky flies over this county, we cannot serve our famous moonshine or our Jell-O moonshine shots. What county would that be?
I don't know the answer to that one.
Neil?
I have no clue.
Bill?
Not a clue.
That would be Breathitt County because they're a dry county, and you have to know these things when you fly on our Kentucky. All right, well, number five. When our Kentucky flies over this county, we can serve moonshine and our Jell-O moonshine shot. What county would that be?
I'm at a loss for that one also.
Would that be probably the county of, I don't know, it would be Perry County or is it
well,
Perry
Captain
County?
Neil, have you been to Kentucky? My gosh.
A couple of times.
It's Perry County, and that's where Hazard is, and that's where Margaret and Luann, myself, are from.
I think I heard you talk about that one time, Luann.
I did, and they're called the Wet County.
Yeah.
And by the way, all the people from Breathitt County sneak over there all the time.
I think you've got one more question. And Jim Hart, let me see if your microphone is working any better now. Jim, are you still with us? Are you still there, Jim? No, his microphone apparently must have given up.
Okay.
But there's one other question.
This is Steve. I just read also, and maybe you can confirm this, that the state slogan for Kentucky is the state for beautiful horses and fast women. Is that correct?
Well, now, Steve, the way I heard that, it's fast women and beautiful horses. No, what is it? Oh, my goodness, I think I messed up on that. Well, it was always, you know, beautiful women and fast horses, but we kind of say fast women and beautiful horses. Now, I do have one more.
Is this the bonus question?
Yeah, this is the bonus question. Well, no,
we get to be president of the airline if we answer this
one. Yeah,
something
like that. Well, yeah, you get to sit in the jump seat or something. Now, this is not really a question, but it's a request that we have of all our potential pilots. We want to know how strong is your back, because, you know, sometimes we haul coal in these airplanes that we have. And you ought to see how much coal we can get in that little Learjet. You know, it starts out being red, and it's just plum black by the time we land. I mean, you know, that coal just flying out the winders and everything, because we fly under the radar, you know. But anyway, so we do ask them, because our pilots, in addition to flying, you know, they have to load coal on that plane. So that's just something that has to be done. Now, here
I have a very strong back, Luann, and I will even go to the effort of getting a trainer to even strengthen that.
You know what? That's just the kind of attitude that we want from our potential pilots. And so, you know what? Even though you missed most of the questions, I think we might hire you, you know?
If he can use a shovel.
Yeah, I mean, that coal thing just cinched it right there. You know,
Do I have to bring my own shovel?
Yes, you do. We don't issue standard shovels. You know, most people there have to, you know, they need their own shovels to shovel coal, so you don't have one. But actually, here's the bonus question. What is a Kentucky shoe? I mean, how do you describe a Kentucky shoe? That's S-H-O-E.
I would say it would be a horseshoe.
Well, I was going to say an inverted U.
I believe inverted U is what we're looking for. So,
and how do you put them on? With nails.
Anyway, but that's how we do it. And so that's my questions. And you know what, Steve? Anytime you want a job, or Bill, you want a job, and for sure, Captain Neil, you want a job. Oh, and by the way, Captain Paul out there, who normally flies our airline, is ill, and Captain Leon Harper is taking his place. And I do believe, Neil, he's going to be with us next weekend.
Oh, wonderful. That's great.
And that'll be great. So if you're listening, Captain Harper, we salute you, and we'll see you next week when our Kentucky takes off.
We have a caller from area code 770. Caller, can you identify yourself? Are you there?
Sonny Smithwick, I'm listening.
Sonny, how are you?
I'm doing just fine, thank you, sir, Neil.
Where are you calling from, Sonny?
I'm in Fayetteville, Georgia. I listened to the first radio show that you had, and I have missed several of them, but I wanted to call in tonight and listen. I was with Eastern back in 1963. I actually met Captain Izzy Rickenbacker.
1963. You were hired then, or you were working at the time?
Actually, in 1963, May 1963, I was hired as a part-time agent while I was going to school. And then I ended up in dispatch later years in Miami.
Did you ever meet the captain coming through Atlanta?
Well, actually, the way we used to do it, prior to 1969, that's when we moved to Miami, and Eastern was probably the first airline that consolidated the operational control, which was, at that time, Eastern was in New York, Miami, and Atlanta, and in 1969, they consolidated everything in one area in Miami. Prior to that, we were in Atlanta, and the crews, when they would come through, they would actually come into the counter, and we would give them a briefing on their flight, and it was really a personal camaraderie between the dispatchers and the captains at that time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, now that was in the old terminal, wasn't it, over there?
Yeah, it was actually
Virginia
on the second
Avenue.
Yeah, it was on the second floor. On the second floor there, that the crews would come up in the old green, the green terminal at that time, and that was about 1969.
I remember it well.
Yeah, yeah. Pappy Wendt. I guess I don't know if you remember Pappy Wendt and George Finnegan. They were some of our high-ranking members of management at that time.
No, you were in the room that was almost opposite where the crews checked in, and also crew scheduling.
I said, that's correct. Going at that time, prior to computers, at that time, we would on teletype, we would send out the dispatch releases on teletype, and we would actually send it from our desk in a tube, and it would go down to teletype. They would retype the whole thing, and then by the teletype, it would send it out to New York, Miami, and of course Atlanta, if they needed to be. But they've come a long way since then.
Yeah. Now you've retired for quite a while. What are you doing now, Sonny?
Well, after Eastern, we started Carnival Airlines out of Fort Lauderdale, and then most recently I retired from AirTran. I was a director of system operations at AirTran up until 5 years ago, and currently I'm with the FAA.
Okay, are you with the FAA there in Atlanta?
Yes, I am, yes, and actually assigned to Delta Airlines.
Well, you know several of my good friends, Bob Bruce, of course.
Oh, Bob is no longer
yeah,
with us, you know.
Yeah, he passed away a couple of years ago. How about Bothwell. What's his name?
Charlie Boswell.
Charlie Boswell.
Charlie Boswell is a 757 guy. He works with us with the FAA. He's with the FAA. He's assigned to Delta, and he does what they call ASAP right now, and they allow him to work from his home, and he comes down every Thursday to the airport and works with Delta there. But Charlie Boswell has some good stories. He needs to tell one story about himself and his son that flies for USA, or maybe we could get him on here one night to tell about that. It's the funniest
thing
that
would
you've ever
be
heard.
Great. Yeah, I know Charlie pretty well, and he's a good friend of Virgil Tedder. Of course, Virgil never went with the FAA. He went over to Delta and was a simulator instructor. I think he's still instructing simulators for Delta.
He was. I had dinner with him actually about a year ago now that we all got together and had dinner with him. But I did meet Virgil, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, good group of guys there. And the thing about Bob Bruce was that the day of his retirement, as you probably well know this, Sonny, the day of his retirement was the day of the Eastern strike.
Oh,
I believe he retired the day before. And then, as the story goes, he went across the street and started to work for the FAA.
Yeah, I didn't realize that, Neil, that was his retirement date. I really didn't realize that. But I know him from, from ValueJet days. I was also with ValueJet, and then we bought AirTran some years later, and he was involved in that.
Yeah, before I forget it, Luann wants to talk with you. But one thing, since you mentioned ValueJet, and while we're talking about Bob Bruce, I helped start an airline up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and the name of the airline was AirTran.
Uh-huh.
And so I went through Atlanta one time, and I stopped by Bob Bruce, and I went up to the FAA there and chatted with him, and I said, Bob, I said, I need all the help I can get because we're working up the flight operations for a new airline in Pittsburgh called AirTran. Well, now, this was before, of course, AirTran, but he had just been the principal office, and I think he had just signed off the certification of ValueJet, which he was a POI.
Right.
So he started to tell me about that, and he took out several of his manuals, ValueJet manuals, and I said, man, they're using the same airplanes we're going to use up in Pittsburgh. I said, Bob, I said, would you let me take these home and make some copies of it? And Bob says, no, I don't think I can do that. But now I can tell this. That he says, why don't you go in that room and take all the notes that you want to take, and so let me take those books over to another room and I had some time with Value Jets Books. But Lou Ann has something to tell you.
Mr. Sonny Smith, first of all, at our Kentucky, we just want to tell you how much we appreciate you people up there at the FAA. But I have one little question. How much of the information that I passed along about our application process did you hear?
On the pilot's application, you know, I was on my computer listening at that time, and I dialed in. But yes, I was listening to that. I don't know as a dispatcher that I would if asked.
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, I was just hoping you didn't hear about them moonshine shots, because those are for medicinal purposes only. And it,
you know, I didn't hear that.
Wonderful, Ben. Well, just ignore it. Just ignore it.
Don't worry, Lou Ann. You're not going to get any trouble, not any more trouble than you've already been in. One other question for you, Sonny. I forgot what the question was. But since you're talking about dispatch, did you know Gary Ivester?
Gary Ivester, yeah. Actually, Gary was, he was in crew schedule, and then he came to dispatch, and he and I, we had a few good nights out together in Miami, you know, when we moved down there around 1970, 72 to Miami. But, yeah, I did know Gary Ivester, and actually he was sort of a distant cousin in my family that I really didn't know about at the time.
Okay, well, perhaps he told you that when he was in dispatch with Eastern, or in crew scheduling, I believe, at one time, and then he went over to dispatch, he came through my school. I had a school in Atlanta at the time that I operated with my late partner, John Corni, and we operated a school called Georgia Flyers School of Aviation. And we had an air agency certificate, an air carrier air agency certificate, that we had an approved flight engineer ground school. And we did a contract with Piedmont Airlines, U.S. Air, Allegheny, I think it was, initially. And when they first got their first 727s, we did all of their ground school training. And Gary came through our school, and we taught the ATR as well, the airline transport rating, which we call it the ATR in those days. Mm-hmm. And with that, I think he was able to go over and take his dispatch exam, FAA exam, and passed it. And from there, I think he went into full-time dispatching. And then from what I heard, he was with Atlanta Center as well.
Yeah, he was. And actually, when he went to the Atlanta Center, I think he was he was doing some home building, and he was doing several things. And I think for some reason I'm thinking he might have left the FAA and was just doing home building.
He hasn't passed away, has he? He's still alive.
Neil, I don't know if he has or not. I've sort of lost track of him, and I really couldn't tell. I don't have any information on that.
No. Well, and tell everyone hello for us, listen in, too.
You might have known Ed Walters. I don't know if you knew Ed Walters, one of the crew schedulers in Atlanta.
Him so well.
Yeah, he's an old Marine, and he worked there with Gary Ivester at the time, and actually he ended up as a dispatcher also. He was a card.
I don't recall him.
Okay.
Yeah. But it seemed like only yesterday when you sit there and reflect back to those days, and I can almost see that long counter in Atlanta Dispatch.
Yeah, and that's when we do we had the Convair 440s and the Martin 404s and at that time I think we had one Connie left, and I think it was hauling engines around on it at one. We had one Connie. We used to haul engines around on. I think it was based in Miami. That was around 69 or so.
I think.
But that was a beautiful airplane.
Yeah. Sonny, we have a caller. I'm going to see if I can hook up with the area code 321. Area code 321, are you with us?
Sure am, Neil. This is your old neighbor from Miami. This is Ray Now on the line.
Ray Now. Good, my goodness. Now, Jim Hart knows you, Ray. And also, maybe Bill Joseph knows Ray now. Do you know Bill Ray now?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
I was a sales manager in Baltimore, and I knew Ray very well from his time.
Yeah, it's been going back. You know, this week was, this month has been a very memorable month. 40 years ago, Eastern Airlines and Walt Disney World opened together. The Eastern relationship, that was a marketing coup for the airline industry, in particular for Eastern Airlines. We had a reunion of a number of our former Eastern Walt Disney World employees over in Orlando, and it was a lot of storytelling, and including gentleman Ed Northcutt. I think, Bill, you remember Ed Northcutt?
Absolutely.
Been involved with Eastern, oh my goodness, he's 87 now, and he has a lot of history that he shared with us. He took over after I left the Disney project and reopened Melbourne here on the Space Coast.
Well, you
it was
actually,
one of the biggest coups that ever happened in the airline industry.
It sure was, and I was very pleased to be a part of it, to say the least.
Well, Ray, you were the first one that opened Disney, weren't you?
Right. Yeah, I was there. We were there before it opened. And a little side note, when I was sales rep in Palm Beach several years before, I had two accounts that I called on. One was G and Jensen, which were the engineering firm for Walt Disney World, and then also the golf course architect. Oh, God, I can't, my memory's fading, but he's designed a number of courses throughout the world. He also was down there in the Palm Beach area and showed me the drawings of the future courses. And lo and behold, several years later, there I was right in the middle of it.
Ray? Ray?
Yes.
When you were in your Orlando area there, did you happen to run into my old buddy Jack Coulter?
Yes. You know, I haven't seen Jack for a while. You know, Merle, his lovely bride, passed away a few years back. I understand, according to several of the Eastern people there in Orlando, he's doing well and holding up just nicely, which is good to hear.
That's great.
But it's been interesting to have a chance to catch up with the different people that started with Eastern and Walt Disney World. They came from all the different stations. They were basically part-time agents that became full-time. And they had... I had several languages from Russian, Chinese, Spanish, German. I can't remember. We had a number of international languages because we were expecting because of the international visitors. Mm. And many of them, I think six of them, I think, ended up in sales and marketing with Eastern. Francis Tsai, I don't know, Bill, if you remember Francis. And he was in Charlotte, and he was in St. Louis. Omaha. And then my first supervisor, Ken Martin, ended up as a sales rep for Jack Coulter. And then Ron Raines, he came down from Richmond, and he moved on up and was in Washington sales and several other areas. And then I'm trying to remember a few of the others, but that was one of the things we were very pleased about, able to promote all our people to the next level or higher level within Eastern Airlines. So it was good to have a chance to catch up with them and hear their stories over the last 40 years of what they've been doing.
Ray, I'm sure you have had many stories that you would like to. Have you written any stories down on a piece of paper you might be able to send in to us and be part
To be honest with you, Neil, I have not, but I'm trying to do an article with Joyce Anderson to try to capture some of the Disney moments from 40 years back, so for the EARA papers. So we're working on that as we speak, so hopefully we can share a little bit of that too.
Good. And Bill, I don't know if you knew it, but Ray is in Melbourne, Florida, and I saw Ray about 4 or 5 months ago, wasn't it, Ray, that I went down and had lunch with you?
right? We had a chance to catch up with each other.
And before that, Ray and I date back to the mid-50s.
Yes. Let me tell you.
Well, Ray,
Ray's
been in Melbourne, Florida quite a while.
Yeah, about 35 years, Bill.
Yeah.
That's right.
But the one story that a lot of people don't know about Neil, he was a student pilot at the age of 16. I lived across the street from Neil, and he gave me my first airplane ride. And his instructor, I think, may have been 18 at the oldest. Was that right, Neil?
You've got a fabulous memory. Yeah, he
and
sure was.
You,
yeah.
And I don't think we had a straight line flight. I think there was a lot of roll pauses and whatever. So I figured if I can stand that, I guess I can stand the airline industry. So that was my
instructor. I soloed in 1954, so it was around that time, right?
That's right. That's right. It's almost 60 years. Ooh, yeah.
Golly.
Time flies when we have fun.
Yeah, we sure
are. I'm still working for the Airport Authority as a consultant and working on bringing in a couple of new airlines and from over in Europe to here and also some domestic. So, it keeps me busy. And then my wife and I, we both work one day a week up at the Port Canaveral working the Carnival Dream. So we're able to enjoy our retirement because we get some cruises on Carnival and still have our airline passes. So we have a great time. Great time indeed.
Well, listen, good having you with us tonight, Ray, and come back often, please.
Oh, I will, Neil. Our regards to everyone. Many thanks.
Good to hear you.
Take care.
And say hello to Brenda for us.
I sure will. Likewise. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Well, guys, Sonny, we were talking with you about Miami Dispatch. You still with us?
Yes, I am, Neil. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, Bob Bruce retired when he was, I think he was in his 75 or something like that from the FAA?
When he left the FAA, he wanted to be the oldest person in the FAA, and I think he was close to 80.
Yeah.
I think he was trying to get 80, if I remember right, and he didn't quite make that.
Yeah.
Yes,
but well,
they had
to
fly over for him, and he lives down on just south of the airport here, and they had a big flyover for him, and it was pretty neat.
Yeah, I knew Bob and Marilyn, his wife, real well. They used to live up on Lake Lanier. Steve used to live up there as well.
Yes.
Probably. Steve, you didn't live too far from Bob Bruce, I don't guess.
Yeah, as I remember him living in Stone Mountain, that's where I knew him.
Oh, okay. Well, he had a cabin up there, yeah.
He did have a cabin, yes.
Yeah.
Right.
But,
you had a cabin on Lake Lanier?
Yeah.
You can't have a cabin up there anymore. It's all million-dollar houses now.
Oh, yeah. Well, then my little old $25,000 cabin, I don't know, they probably torn it down and put up a mansion, I'm sure.
I'm sure they have.
Yeah. But, listen, folks, it's been real nice talking with everyone tonight, and we certainly enjoyed telling some stories about the writings that mostly these, of course, come from pilots that have written articles for the Retired Eastern Pilots Association magazine, and it's included in that CD that we can send to you, or if you would like to purchase that and have all of these stories available to you. But we're collecting memories, and we're hopefully going to publish a book of memories of Eastern stories sometime around December. We hope to have it published. Margaret, do you have anything else to add to our show tonight?
I had started to say something before Lou Ann came in, but...
One happy birthday.
Yes, we do.
To my real good friend, Tom Fryer, who finally made it to 75. So, Tom Fryer, if you're listening out there in the Bay Area, California Bay Area, happy birthday, my friend.
And I just want to say, be sure, folks, to tune in again next Monday at 7 p.m. when Eastern Flight 40 will be taxiing from the gate with another true adventure from the Eastern Files.
And Neil,
that's our go ahead.
And to Luann, thank you for, and I am so looking forward to my new job with Air Kentucky. And at a future time, I will tell you about what is hopefully my first trip with Air Kentucky, which will be, I'm sure, just a very eventful flight.
It's just going to be one of the most exciting adventures you have ever had, and we're all going to look forward to that first time. And thank you. Come on board, Steve.
Thanks, Luann.
Well, folks, that's our show for tonight, and we hope you enjoyed it. So from the Eastern Radio Show and the Eastern family, where all the women are unequaled, all the men are good-looking, and all the children and grandchildren are above average, we'll say
good night. Good night, Bill. Good night, Steve. Good night, Neil.
Good night, Margaret. Good night, Neil. Good night, Steve.
Good night, everybody from Roar and Gap.
Good night, Bill, Jim, Margaret, Steve, and Luann, wherever you are, you're sitting right here.
And this is Luann again saying good night to all. And you know what I always say? Make sure you fly right side up. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody. Thank you.